I'm still Episcopalian.
Yes, yes, sir.
We belong to Grace.
I want to shoot a picture of you outside your office, if I may.
You can get us all in, can't you?
Oh, yeah. Right. That's no problem. I just have to make sure I have the proper light.
All right.
It's all right?
Yes, it's fine.
I have no way to get jealous.
I'm having to learn to use this camera all over again. Mm-hmm. I'll get it in a minute.
Okay. Get one later right now.
Yeah.
You know what happened? The other camera was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just gotten that one as a replacement. He assumes that he did give him
one. All right.
All right. Pleasure.
I'll try it.
You'll try another
make
one.
Sure, make sure. And
so.
Yes, and he's
thank you.
All right, Henry, come on. You come so you can have it right here with the bishop.
Mm-hmm.
Keep this thing together.
You got supplies, Sean. You
can use it. I'm not using
it.
You can use it outdoors,
you know.
I got enough.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, I'll be looking for you in the morning then.
Yes.
And I'll be waiting anxiously.
How do you get away? How you get away?
We'll go out and get a cab.
Well, you better let me call her.
Oh, yeah, instead of just getting it in the street.
This is a picture of my mother.
Oh, yes, remember yes, yes. Remember her? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Can't forget her. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Fountain was very fluent in Latin.
I had left the Episcopal Church and joined the Anglican Church.
You can call me up.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Fountain was a great scholar.
Great scholar. Yeah, he was a doctor of philosophy.
Yeah,
yes, me. Yeah, well, so, anyhow.
He was a graduate of Lincoln University. So
yes, he was a very great man.
I finished the same college.
He's gone to Germany, hadn't he? He'd gone some degree, I think, in Germany. A very great man. His son was So his son was afterwards head of Morris Brown. So anyhow, he told me when he took in the I sent the thesis to him, you know. So he said when he took it into this committee, they looked at it and said, "Well, we may as well give this man the degree. We can't read it, but I suppose he deserves it."
But Brown could read it.
Oh, yes, Tony could read it, yes. He could.
As I remembered, he was a graduate of Lincoln University.
Yes, that's
originally,
right.
And I'm a Lincoln man, so you're that's why I happen to remember that.
Yeah.
Sit down.
Sorry, I haven't got a sofa seat to offer.
Well, this is fine.
I see. Before you went into the African Orthodox Church.
Yes, I was in the Army Church, and I tell you why I left it. I was teaching, I love teaching, so they sent me to teach at Lambton College in Louisiana. Then they moved me to Everwater College,
Jacksonville,
and they intended to make me president of that.
Mm.
Because Dr. Cooper, who was a Georgian, didn't want to be president. And so Bishop Hurst was the bishop. And he said, "You're just holding me down to make me president next year." And one day, a fool fella got in the chapel and made some very nasty remarks about West Indians. Well, I'm very hot-tempered, you see, not so bad now. When it came my turn to speak, I just tore him apart.
Oh.
Tore him apart.
And that did away with your presidency?
Yeah, yes, and I decided I would stay. So then Mr. McGuire, Bishop McGuire, had a church in Miami, and he came down, and he didn't know what was going on, but I intended to leave because I could have got any position I wanted up north. Mm. So Bishop McGuire came and offered me to work for, if I'd take charge of the church in Brooklyn. So Bishop Hurst told me to go. He said that he thought I could do better work there than I could at Eric Walker's.
So the church was already established when you went there?
Yeah, it was a small church. I only had 13 members.
Oh.
And I built it up in 6 months to 2,000.
Yeah, well, this was what I wanted to ask you about. Can we talk now or should we go?
Sure, yes. Yeah. If you want it, you have time.
Yeah, well, this is what I was...
Can I get you something cool to drink? I haven't got anything to offer you with something.
No, this is fine.
Yeah.
I was interested in how you grew so rapidly, what you did for... Well, for instance, what did you use for buildings?
Well,
Did you use storefront or
house? When I went there first, I got a building on... No, you know, there's a place called Schubert Palace, which is now the Elks Hall on Fulton Street. You must know it. It's been remodeled and enlarged, but it was the Elks Hall. It then belonged to a fellow called Ed Mead, and he kept it for a dance hall.
Oh, yeah.
So my first few months, Ed Mead was very fond of me because I was a friend of his brother, who was a minister in Manhattan.
Yeah.
So he gave me the use of this hall on Sunday nights. Uh-huh. Only kept a Sunday night service.
Yeah.
And as I got out of the service on Sunday night, the dance people came in.
Oh, right afterwards. They did it out.
I had money of my own, and I had one of my wife's cousins, the Prime Minister's mother's cousins.
Mm.
She was there in Brooklyn. And the two of us joined together, and this church belonging to the AME Zion Church on Clawson and Atlantic. Between Atlantic
and when they moved to the big church.
Yeah, afterwards. But we bought within 6 months. No, I came there in September 25. And by November 25, I had bought this church with my own men, because there were only 13 people in the congregation.
Mm.
But my wife's cousin and myself bought the church. We paid for it.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a phenomenon because people couldn't understand how I could come there
so quick.
And in 2 months, 3 months, get a church when men had been there for years practically and were still struggling, see?
Yeah.
So that caused what you call a rush to see this curiosity. And then I used to preach some very radical sermons. You see, I was against them. I used to preach this hellfire. I don't believe in hell, of course, and I don't believe in heaven either. So I used to teach what I call the social gospel.
Uh-huh.
And I was to force lynching and all that kind of thing. I made it made the church a social organization.
You will probably be very interested to know that I remember Reverend Harton.
Oh, yes, but he's my great friend.
When he preached Bill Bowles' funeral, you remember that?
Yeah, yes, I think he did.
He borrowed the Concord Church and preached
Bill Bowles'
funeral and took a big offering, and nobody ever knew what happened to him.
Yeah, you didn't know.
Harton was a great fellow for stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, yes, Harton and I, we became, when I left in 64, he and I were the oldest clergymen in Brooklyn in point of service. But all the other men had died or had removed, because he was there in 23 and I came in 25.
Mm.
And in 64, we were the last two remaining of that batch. Yeah.
Now, you had 2,000 members in little or no time. Where did those members come from?
Most, you see, I had served here in the West Indies in Barbados, and I had served in St. Vincent. I'd been rector back then in St. Vincent, and I served...
That was Anglican.
In Anglican, you see.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of these people who had known me in my former parishes here. So the minute they heard I was there, not the flock to the church.
Yeah, in other words, it was built very largely with people from the West Indies.
From the West Indies, mostly. I only had about 30 or 40 native people, and I had about 40 white folk. I was a member of the Baha'i organization. In that time, the Baha'is were supposed to be a philosophy and not a religion.
Yeah.
And so these Baha'is, some of them very rich, and they were my great supporters, so that sometimes I didn't take a check from my church sometimes for 12, 14 months. Because,
what?
Yes, because the Baha'is, I used to lecture for them, and they supported me well.
Mm.
And so I let the my money go back into the church, you see.
Mm.
And people, and so... we had quite a, and I had a Sunday school of about 700
700
by Sunday school children. Tremendously. On Sundays, the people used to gather, people tell you, used to gather outside the church between Atlantic and Lefferts. And the police had to block off. No traffic could pass there because the church at the time could only hold about 700, that church. And they would step outside and wait to hear what the others had to say when service was over.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it was quite phenomenal.
And so most of them were ex-Anglicans?
Most of them were ex-Anglicans, yes. Most of them.
Would that be true of most of the African Orthodox Church?
Most of it, yes. It would be true of most of them. True of most of them,
yeah.
Because most of the ministers who were serving were like Maguire. You see, he was a doctor and a pastor in Antigua. And he was well known in Antigua. And then he'd also pastored in Arkansas. Under Bishop, the famous Bishop Brown, you know.
Oh,
the man that preached, banish God from the skies and cast us from the earth.
Oh, I knew him.
You knew Bishop Brown. So he had a large following, too.
And he was a former AME, too, then?
Yes, he was full short toy, but he was a former Anglican, so,
uh-huh.
like myself. I joined the AME Church because I was transferred from here to the Virgin Islands to the Episcopal Church there, the rector of the Holy Cross in St. Croix. Where my daughter is now. I have a daughter there who's a pharmacist. And this bishop called me a nigger. First interview. First interview I had with Bishop Colmore. Mm. So I'm talking to him, you know, I was sitting out like this, you know. And the former bishop who was here that I had left here was the first cousin of Queen of Victoria.
Oh.
And he was a very eminent man. He was a son of the Duke of Cambridge, the Queen's uncle. And we used to talk when we were finished business. We talked like I'm talking to you. And here I come talking to this man. And he tells me, well, he wasn't accustomed to having his nigger clergyman speak to him like that. Oh! So I got right up. I said, well, excuse me, my Lord Bishop, this interview's ended. And by the time he got back to Frederickstead, I was in Christian, in what they call a grove place in the middle of the country, in the Holy Cross Church. And he was staying with the rector of Frederickstead. By the time he got back to Featherstone, my resignation was behind him. I sent my coachman with my resignation. So I went to the church and I told the people what had happened. The church had about 350 members. Four were planters' families and the rest were, you know, laborers and artisans.
Yes.
So when I told them, this happened on a Saturday. So when I told them the Sunday what had happened, they said, well, they would write to him and ask him to come and have an interview with him because he was supposed to be in there in St. Croix. So when they sent to him the Sunday after service, he had taken service at St. Mary's Church and had gone. The bishop, the governor had given him his boat, you know, the governor's boat, and he'd gone back to Puerto Rico. So they telegraphed him, and they gave him until the Tuesday to answer. So we met the Tuesday night, and he didn't answer. So the Tuesday night, the people came out of the church, and they locked it and barred it. And they stayed locked and barred for over. Send me if you worship on the tambourine tree, we will go wherever you are. Everybody, the families, the planter families.
Even the planter families?
Yeah. Everybody came out. So the church was shut. So I had then to start, you know, with these people. And they had a law at that time. You couldn't operate in the Virgin Islands except you were connected with some known and established church.
So
it happened that I had been friendly with the minister here, the AME minister here. So I wrote him, and he made the connection for me, and so I joined the AME Church that way.
Very interesting.
And then I ran the AME Church, then built up four churches in the Virgin Islands before I left. But they threw me out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know that.
Who threw you out?
The government.
Oh!
Oh, yeah, they threw me out.
They took you off the island.
Yeah, they banished me. In 1922, on the 22nd of October, they gave me 5 days to leave.
Otherwise, the Anglican Church would have disappeared.
The AME Church.
They were afraid that if you stayed there, that there wouldn't be any Anglican Church.
Well, I had one which closed down. I had the Catholic Church partly closed. And I had the Anglican partly closed, yeah. I had 6,000 members. In between 1920, when I joined the AME Church, and 22, when they threw me out, I had 6,000 members. It was most of the people.
You could say, on the island.
Yeah. Oh, so they used to call me the hurricane preacher. I was terrible radical, you know, terrible. You see, they had the Navy At the time, the Navy was governing the islands. See, when they bought the islands, they turned them over to the Navy because President Wilson was too busy with the war to be bothered about these few niggers, as he called them. See, because he was a Southern himself.
Oh, I know. Wilson was bad.
Yeah. So he turned us over to the Navy. And they used to run the islands like a battleship. You had to jump and run whenever they told you to jump and run, see. And I wouldn't jump and run. So I joined the labor union, which was a crime at that time.
Oh.
You know, like being a communist, you know, to join the labor union.
Mm.
Minister too, you know. So, and I ran the labor paper called the Herald, a daily paper that the labor union supported.
Mm.
And I used to give them a fit in that paper, you know.
Oh.
I still fit. Oh. I got two governors removed, and I got a vice governor removed. But reporting delinquencies.
And now this is the United States government we're dealing
with.
We left the Queen and it was just as bad
after
you got to the United States.
Yes, yes. I didn't care once they were pressing my people and putting them even here now. People expect me to endorse all that my son does. I tell him I can't do that. I say he's my son, all right. But sometimes he does things I don't like, and if I don't like it, I say it. So the threat was to deport me from here, you know.
And your son is the Prime Minister.
Yes, I'm father the Prime Minister because I enforce certain things here. They told me if I'm not careful, they throw me out the island. They would do it too, you know. So I piped down a little bit.
I want to get back to this church. You, in your church, then you had a group very largely West Indian, hard-working people that you might call very lower middle class.
Yes, yes, mostly.
Yeah. Now Garvey had a whole lot of very poor Southern blacks, right?
A lot of them, yes. He had a large father, very large father.
But apparently none of them went into... Your church was liturgical, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
And they didn't, and it didn't draw this same group of people?
Not largely from them. Yes. It's so largely from the old Anglican members.
So that the overlap between the UNIA... I remember the UNIA. Yeah. I'm that old myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I can remember their hall very well. They had old raggedy building in...
30th Street. 130th Street.
Yeah, well, I mean, in my hometown, out in Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever know a man by the name of Amos? He was an African Orthodox priest and I think bishop out in California.
I can't recall him. Amos.
The African Orthodox Church there is in a little black community is still there.
Still there.
Out in the country. There's still three or four people and they still insist that they have the church and the church is still operating.
No, yeah. I didn't remember him.
You didn't know him at all?
You see, I as I told you, I lectured largely for the Baha'is. And even though I was bishop of the African Orthodox Church, I had six assistant ministers in this church of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, I hardly ever functioned except on high festivals like Easter and Whit Sunday, Christmas Day, I was there at the church. And most of the time, I was out. So I knew little, and I hardly attended their sinners, hardly. They didn't like me for that. Because I didn't believe in all this claptrap, you know, and I didn't believe in all of the ritual. Even the robes, I didn't like to wear them. I had a most elaborate set of robes, and I would go into church sometimes just in my cassock. I never dared go in with my coat and pants then. But now I go in, I am a Roman Catholic, now I joined the Roman Church, and I go to church the last Sunday, where the church just like I am now. And the priest asked me to come and take part in the service. I go, look, hey, I mean, don't want me. I have my robes, but I don't put them on. My father's black, what they call a West Indian white, you see. And
so your mother was black?
Black.
But your father was almost
black? Almost, he looked like a white, look like the average white man here, you see. Because he was the son of an Englishman who was rector here in St. Philip.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in 1837. And in those days, the clergy always had a couple of families.
Oh yes,
well, up to my time.
The clergy had a white family
and a black family, yes, and a non-white family. When I was a boy going to school here at the age of 12, the dean of the cathedral, Dean Clark was dean here at the cathedral and lived in the rectory where the hospital is now. It's been torn down.
Yeah.
And he lived there in Barton's Road, and he had about six colored children from a woman on Bay Street. And one of his grandsons is an eminent doctor in London. If you ever heard of Dr. Bertie Clark, a very eminent man. And his Bertie's father, the dean's son, is one of my best friends. He lives up here, a very rich man. He lives up here you know where the Astor, you must have passed the Astor Hotel, going up Hastings.
No, I've been going up and down Bay Road.
Yes, but anyhow, Mr. Clark owns Palm Beach, and he just sold out some of his land to this Astor Hotel for $1.5 million. He's such a rich man.
And these people acknowledge their relationship.
Oh, yes, because you see what the white man did here, he always trained his children.
Black or white.
Oh, yes, he always educated them.
This is why you have this very low illiteracy rate here. Very high literacy rate.
Well, take the Ward family. You hear the Ward family.
The Rum Bunch.
Well, they're the richest family in the island, regardless of white or color. And two brothers always had black children from black women. They wouldn't marry, but they had a preponderance of children.
Yeah, I understand. One of them had 64 children.
Something like that, yes. When I was cured at St. Lucie, A.F. Ward, whose name is on the bottles, the rum bottles today, he was the church warden, and he had a great house family. Then in the yard, he had a cottage, about 5-room cottage with another family. And then all over the plant, he owned plantations, not just one.
Yeah, I know.
And wherever he could get a child, he had a child.
Really?
So when he died, he left them all money. He left everyone well off. He was a millionaire, you know.
Yeah.
And he trained everyone that would take education, he gave it to them. So that we have a judge on the bench now, Judge Erskine Ward. Well, Erskine is retired. He was former judge of Honduras. And he's now head of the Sugar Producers Association. So get how rich he is, they have to make him head of the sugar plantations here in Barbados. Then this judge, the other ward, Dighton Ward, he's a Supreme Court.
These are blacks?
All blacks, yes. Yeah. And I say they're the richest people on the island. When they combine, nobody can oppose them financially.
Let me get back to what you were saying before. You had grown up, and all of these people had grown up in Orthodox Anglicanism, and you simply couldn't buy the Garvey idea about black God or black theology.
Not at that time, no, we didn't. I mean, this is a development quite recently. That we went along the Orthodox road, just separating ourselves from the prejudice of the white man. And this was our point, that what was the use of our leaving the white prejudice to create prejudice ourselves. So in our church, we opened the church to everybody. Anybody who wanted to join, whether it was a Chinaman or a Japanese or a European, he was welcome to join.
But it was African Orthodox
Church. But we named it African Orthodox, so that we kept the control, you see, of the church in our hands. But we didn't have any segregation policies.
It's very interesting that Cronin made the big mistake of assuming that they were so close together because McGuire had been his deputy, but it was just apparently for a short time.
Just for a short time. He was just a chaplain general for a very short time, and he and Garvey fell
out. He was chaplain general.
Chaplain general of the organization. And he and Garvey fell out very early in their relationship. And in fact, the quarrel was so great that when I went there in 25, McGuire couldn't leave his house. Bishop Brooks used to have to bring in his meals or his wife. He was at 224 West 135th Street, and he could not leave the house.
In other words, Garvey's people were that...
After him, yes. They were the
violently after him.
And a couple of years afterwards, he was speaking in Metropolitan Baptist Church.
Yeah.
And some of the Garvey... You must have heard that incident.
I know where Metropolitan Baptist Church is, and I remember the families. Brown was the pastor. Yeah.
The people came in, Mr. Moore, Richard B. Moore, the bookstore man, he was there at the meeting tonight. He told me some of the Garvey people came in to assassinate McGuire. He was the chief speaker, and one of the officers of the church was quick enough to put out the lights. He switched off the main light, and then they got McGuire out through the back door.
Goodness.
And that was years after.
Now, what did they fall out about?
Garvey accused McGuire, Garvey sent him to Cuba to organize some branches of the UNIA.
Yeah.
And Garvey accused McGuire of paying more attention to his church business than to the UNIA business. You see, that was...
That was what Leslie came back and told us.
That's true.
And that's what...
caused the quarrel.
Yeah. Tell me this, you had 2,000 members. Today the church is very small, I take it, or is it still very large?
Fairly large. They have the $1 million church now on Putnam Avenue. which I think still has a good many members. They have about 2,000 because, I mean, it was largely my name and a personal following, more or less than,
Transplanted from the island.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's still a large church.
It's still a large church. And then there are several other churches. And Bishop Miller, a Trinidadian, he has St. Simon's. You know St. Simon's, huh? Yes.
Yeah, where is St. Simon's African Orthodox?
Yes.
And where is that located?
That's somewhere down the town. Is it Clinton Avenue? You know, it got, it was on Clifton Place, and it got destroyed. It was a large wooden building, and the worms ate it. And one Sunday, just after service, the roof collapsed.
Oh, my goodness.
Just after service, it would have killed all the congregation. Mm. And then I understand he's somewhere on downtown Clinton. He got a... They tell me, I think it's a Presbyterian church that was sold here. But he does have a church.
And the name of your church was?
My church was changed from Christ Church to St. Leonard's.
St. Leonard's?
Yeah.
And St. Leonard's is one you say now has $1 million church?
Yes, it's a church. And I was told when I was leaving there in 64, the Charles people said that if it got burnt, it was only insured for about 300,000. And they told me, they said, if you don't get these people insured, this church, and anything happens to you, it'll be just like Concord. They said they couldn't rebuild a church of that size for less than about $1.5 million.
That's right.
So, you know, Concord took about $1.25 million, didn't it?
To
rebuild it. This church was all more even elaborate. It was a Jewish synagogue, you know, that we bought from Jews. Very elaborate, and has beautiful furnishings. Before he left, it cost $22,000 just to repaint it.
$22,000 just to paint it?
Just to redecorate it, yeah.
Oh,
yes, so you can understand.
But in the later years, you never returned back to a very close relationship as pastor.
No. I only supervised, and then I withdrew.
When you retired, you right up to the time of retirement, you were working with the Baha'i, perhaps more than with the African Orthodox
Church.
It's interesting to me that it's still there, a large church.
It's still there.
Yeah. Still there, and still very
still going. Yes. Still. And then there's one fellow just got killed, Bishop Smith. He was pastor of St. Michael's Church up in East New York on Amboy Street. And the government took over the church, I understand, quite recently, and he's now on Troy Avenue. I forget the number, but I give it to you before you leave. And he got killed Christmas Eve in an automobile accident. And he was a very successful pastor, too. So that there are those three churches in Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me that this group, this little tiny church in California, still claims relationship to that same group. I'm wondering if they ever go back. Huh? Fairmead, I think. It's near Fairmead is it's a practically all black small community near a place called Chowchilla, which is, and if you go a little to the south, there's a place called Madera, and you go 22 miles below that, and there's a place called Fresno. And I was pastor at Fresno.
Fresno.
So at Fresno, I became, well, it wasn't it? I used to cover all of Northern California, and I knew about this African Orthodox Church, and I've seen the little building, not any bigger than this room, I guess.
Yes, I suppose so, yes.
But this Amos family are very dedicated to the maintenance, the continuance of the African Orthodox Church in California, in that place.
Yeah.
And one of the sons I saw in Los Angeles, not a year ago. And he thought there was a group meeting there, but he hadn't been faithful enough to go see them. Well, I went to see them, and I found a crackpot, and he wasn't at all related to the African Orthodox Church that you know.
Yeah.
He was one of these fellows, you could talk to him all day, and the same story would never come out. It would always be different.
I see.
Yeah, he was in bad shape.
Yeah, I see. You know, what I wanted to tell you was that the greatest success of the African Orthodox Church was in South Africa. We had a man that came there in 26, a very educated man, and he was Bishop Daniel Alexander, and he was consecrated by McGuire and sent back. And when I last heard before he left, he had over 1,000 churches in South Africa. You know,
1,000 African Orthodox churches
in South Africa. That's the biggest group of churches we ever had. And because you know they have this apartheid there, and of course it. Just like in South America, the people had to keep by themselves. And he seemed to be a very popular man. Then we had some success in Guyana. They had a bishop there, I forget what his name is.
But very little success in the islands themselves.
They're too conservative.
The island.
Oh, here in Barbados, you couldn't get it to cool. Even if, of course, I didn't come here to preach. I came here to retire. And then.
But you don't imagine you'd have much success even
no,
if you did.
I wouldn't try it.
You wouldn't try?
Because, first of all, the Catholic churches, your worship is the same as the Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And the people,
you mean the African Orthodox
churches? Identical with the Catholic.
The liturgy is identical with Catholic?
Yes.
Not identical with Anglican?
No. That's Catholic.
Oh.
So strictly Catholic. So what's the good of multiplying?
Yeah, just another name.
Another name. That's another name.
Uh-huh.
So I joined the Catholic Church.
Uh-huh.
And they accepted me as
a priest. They recognized you as a priest.
Yes, yes.
Now, when you left the Virgin Islands and came to the United States, when you were banished,
right.
Is that when you went to Morris Brown?
No. Well, yes. But I had been in correspondence with them before, but I got my degree then.
In other words, you, when you were up to that time, mm-hmm. prior to that time, you had been operating on your training from Codrington College.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you got the degree from Morris Brown.
Well, I went to Northwestern, let's say, and I went to Dalhousie University afterwards in Canada. Took law there, you know.
Oh.
42, that's another story.
Another story.
42, 43, 44, 45.
Right in the middle of your pastorate.
Yes, well, I took leave from the church because I began to tell my people not to go to the war.
And
my friends warned me. They said, now, if you keep on doing this thing, you won't get in jail.
Yeah.
I got an open pulpit and said, this is not your war. I said, we have nothing against the Germans have nothing against you. What are you going to kill Germans for?
Uh-huh.
And so I was committing treason. So some friends of mine got wrong and said, look here, you better get out of this place before they put you in jail. So I didn't have anything, so I took leave from the church. And I went to Dalhousie and sat down there and took law just to find something to do, see.
This explains why I don't know you.
Yeah, exactly.
Because those are the exact years that I worked in Brooklyn.
Oh, I see. That's
yes.
We would have found it. I wasn't there then.
I would have known you if it hadn't been for that.
Exactly.
I was a pacifist and opposed to the war, too. I demonstrated on the White House lawn before World War II.
Yes.
Same sort of thing, but they didn't put me in jail.
Yeah, well,
they put one of my best friends in jail, though.
Yeah, a fellow called Bess. You know him?
Who?
Reverend Bess. He was in Harlem, and he took my same line of preaching. And I wasn't in Dalhousie 2 months before they had him in jail for 4 years.
What?
Yes, they gave him a 4-year sentence, and when he was a Barbadian. And when the sentence was over, they deported him back to Barbados, but he didn't live the jail experience. Was too hard on him.
Broke
his health. So when he came back, he died. Yes, best.
Oh.
Same thing would have happened to me, but it did.
Richard Stenhouse, who was, you know, the
Conscientious.
Stenhouse was a conscientious objector.
Yeah.
And he was a young student at that time.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing him refer to Reverend Best.
Best, yes.
She was working at Imes Church at
the time. Yes, I knew Dr.
St. James Presbyterian. And this Stenhouse that she's talking about, he was a pacifist, and we visited him in a camp for conscientious objectors out in California. After we moved to California, he was still in custody in one of those camps.
I was studying at Union Seminary, and my assignment was up at St.
James.
St. James
Church. Dr. Imes. That's the church in Harlem.
141st and St. Nicholas.
Yes. I attended service there 2 or 3 times on special occasions.
Oh, yes.
He was a very nice man, Dr. Imes. I remember him.
Yes.
I married her from that church.
Oh, yes. Wonderful.
Yeah. We met at Union Seminary.
Yes, at Union.
Yeah. We met on an elevator, in fact, at Union Seminary.
That's very interesting. Dr. Imes. He's a very eminent man.
Yeah.
And there was a man at the Methodist Church that was on Edgecombe Avenue.
Down.
Was
it town?
Yeah.
St. Mark's.
St. Mark's, yes.
I
spoke there with Dr. Du Bois at the Pan-African meeting there once.
Oh.
Du Bois and I were the chief speakers. Excuse me.
Oh.
Yes.
Tomorrow, I think the program for tomorrow is, I come from the morning, and then my friend, young chap, he has just a small car, but it holds us. I don't have to be able to hold him.
They've been around. He's been all over the island anyway.
Yeah. He was born here.
Oh, born here, that's right.
Yeah.
So, this friend of mine, he was a scientist. He learned to be a doctor but he has gone to the bank to work to get money to put himself through college. He's working at the Barclays Bank. A very intelligent boy. He's one of my school boys here.
Oh, yeah.
He's here the morning when I used to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So he he travels very nicely. He has a small, what they call, you know those cars? Austin Mini.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he said he'd take you. I told him he wanted to sell cars in the college.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I haven't seen anything. I'm just most grateful.
Yes, well, we wanted to take you there, and Dr. Bridges, I hope you'll be in. He's the first black man appointed as president of Cardinal College in 268 years.
I read the history of Cardinal College in Africa last summer.
Yes.
Some lady, I don't know why she brought me that, but she insisted that I read it. Who was that? Anyway, I read the history of Cardinal College in Ibadan, Nigeria.
Last
summer.
I wrote a comprehensive history of the college, a very full history, but it was stolen from me.
Read
it again. It was serialized here in one of the papers, and I'd have to go and recopy it because I didn't keep it. Yeah. But it was put in the Observer.
Well, the thing that interested me about the college was that its endowment was in slaves.
Slaves, yes.
It was a church-owned school. Its endowment was not in stocks and bonds. Its endowment was in slaves.
Yes.
And it was not for the training of blacks, in fact. It was for the training of whites for many, many years. It was a long time before they ever trained a black man.
And you say,
but the church was exploiting slave capital.
Yeah.
To train white priests.
That's right.
To save the souls of the blacks.
That's right. Because you see, in those days, Covington couldn't dare talk about freeing the slaves because it wasn't possible. As I explained here in the lecture, the atmosphere of the island at the time didn't even let him do what his will said, because his will said he wanted his slaves Christianized, and for 128 years, and never even appointed a chaplain on the estate.
That's right. I read that.
So
all they did was educate, at that time they educated whites to missionize blacks.
No. But it was an interesting place to see.
I'd love that.
And then I have a friend who has the Atlantis Hotel, Mrs. Maxey, Enid Maxey, a good friend of the family's, she owns the Atlantis. And I generally used to go down there almost every week to spend time with her. She's one of my favorites. So I called her up and told her that I'd bring you down to lunch.
Well, any place on the island that we can go, I would be most grateful.
Yes, and then there's a famous botanic garden called the Andromeda. You've seen Andromeda. It's not. You haven't seen that.
No, I haven't seen any. I've been from Shirley Smith's place to downtown and back.
Yes.
And over here to the modern school and out to the airport, and that's it.
Yes, well, if the weather is good, we try and give you a good round.
Well,
we have to keep moving.
Yeah.
And then the height clear, if we can make height clear, that's belonging to the National Trust. You know height clear? Have you seen Mr. Bradford? You seen height clear?
Height
clear, that's in St. Thomas. It used to be Erie Hill, belonging to the Nurse family, but a white man has bought it and rebuilt it, and they're having it tomorrow as an exhibition by the National Trust.
My
cousin's
taking us there tomorrow.
You're going there too?
They're going there tomorrow.
So I hope we'll be able to get there to see. We think it's open until 5 o'clock, isn't it? So after luncheon, we'll try and get in the Cardinal College and Andromeda before lunch. And then after lunch, we go over to High Clear.
Well, I certainly appreciate that very much.
This gentleman, I'll show it to you tomorrow. That was a high school that was founded in 1789 for whites. And I was the first black man appointed headmaster of it in 1916 because it was a wartime and couldn't get any white men to take it. I had to appoint me because I was the only qualified man at the time free to take it. And I put black children in it, and they raised the devil about and tried to shut the school down.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I fought them and kept the school open. And also, I put nurses in. It's the only government school that's co-ed. Yes, it's co-ed. I put yours in Tommy when I got a big bastard. I say with Bobby, it's for the bastards. We need you more. Make no difference.
He
went to Birkbeck College in London.
Birkbeck?
Birkbeck, yes, that's one of the colleges of London University.
Yeah.
He took quite a lot of training there.
And taught over there?
Taught, yes. And came right here. So I would rather have a screw.
Oh.
I wanted to ask you, do the Catholics here have black priests?
No, one. We have one now. Well, I am in the church now.
Yes.
I function sometimes. But since I was accepted, they have ordained a black priest. And we have a black bishop now. They had all the priests were white.
Yes.
But the tendency was that they were not going to stomach any more white bishops. So they appointed a black man of Barbadian descent. His father was a Barbadian. This boy was born in Jamaica. The father went to Jamaica to work there. And had the boy up there. And he's here now as bishop. He lives at the Prairie. And yes. Yeah,
but he has all but one white priest.
We only have one black priest in there. But they're going to get some more. They're trying to get some more. You see, they never encouraged a vocation among black men. Never did. Because the Catholic Church was the church of the rich, you see. The very rich people. And they never encouraged the black
men. Of course, I wrote an article for a Catholic journal, which was published last August. What's the name of that magazine? I can't remember now. Anyway, I said that they will all have real difficulty recruiting black priests until they do away with celibacy.
Yes.
Because blacks are not going quite so readily to accept.
That's what I told them, sir. I told them so. I said we are not geared for monkhood. There were lovely women in the province, the dog food celibacy. I'll change it. The priest, the bishop, I know him well, but I don't take to him.
Has he got a process mind? You know what I mean?
Yes. He's
black skin
molded,
and white mind?
Molded. And so he and I don't exactly get to talk. He tried to be very polite to me. I was sick the other day, and he wouldn't come. He sent his mother to see me at my home, which was a very great concession. He sent a white priest with his mother to come and visit. But this is my point about him. He has agreed to have married deacons in the church.
And he's
published a brochure in which he's begging the Barbadians to join the white diaconate.
Catholic diaconate.
As colored people, and with the permission to get married. But they haven't been able yet to loose themselves up to have a married priest.
Let me tell you an interesting story. Last September, I flew from Cleveland to Washington, D.C. to see her first cousin ordained one of the first deacons in the new wave of deacons in the Catholic Church.
Right.
They ordained, was it 16?
16, yeah.
And I think over half of them were black.
Black, yeah.
In Washington, D.C., St. Matthew Cathedral. And I sat with my clerical collar with her family while he was ordained deacon.
Wonderful.
And very interesting.
He has four children.
Now, what they do there is to take men who have careers behind them, in many cases middle age, and some of them ready to retire.
Yeah.
And they're going to do this as a second vocation.
Second vocation, yes.
And they train them first, and then when they retire, particularly now a fellow like this, if he retired early, he could be a deacon for 20 years.
Fine.
You know,
fine,
that's the way they're going to ease in the married clergy.
Yes. It'll come in, Jack. It'll come eventually.
But her first cousin, her father's
sister.
Father's sister's son was one of the first black deacons, was one of the first deacons.
He's my age, so he was in his 50s.
Yes, 50s.
Now he has a Master of Arts degree in economics.
Economics, yes.
But now he's working with young people in one of the parishes and serving in the mass and all of that.
He wears his dashiki and his hair.
He's very militant, but he's a deacon also.
That's an improvement. It wouldn't happen 20 years ago.
Not 10 years ago. The trend is...
And there are only two or three cities in the United States where they have it now.
Yes.
Are they planning to run a training course for these deacons?
Oh, yes. They have a training course here. They have place in Trinidad. A wonderful college there. And they have a set of monks there. Black monks. And
they're expecting these men to be full-time then. This will be their full vocation.
Yes, but some of them who are working can also be deacons. They made allowance for them. Yeah. A man who has a job and wants to be a deacon can still be a deacon and follow his work.
Well, that's what these people were doing, and they were training them on weekends, a very intensive weekend.
Yeah.
And the reason I was asking you all these questions, I was just wondering why they didn't wake up to the possibility that maybe, you know, they could get somebody who had already been training people, like, you know, somebody I might know right here, you know.
Yeah.
You could
train the diggers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they offered me, they wanted to have a presentation college. I preached there 2 Sundays ago for the Father Campbell, who's the head of the college and head of the church there. The church was given by a very rich family. They gave the land and they built the church, the Simpson family, who were original engineers and ran a big foundry here. And they gave this beautiful church and gave all the land and built the college. I mean, they were millionaire people. And so they have an Irishman called Campbell up there. He had a good friend. So he asked me to preach for him about 2 Sundays ago, which I did. And then he wanted me to come get a lecture.
Oh.
And some of the training may be done there. But I told him that my hands are so full. You see, I take a lot of interest in my own people, and I teach a lot of my people free. I don't charge.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them come to me on Saturdays.
Oh.
You see, and I still instruct them. So I'm not right. And then I go, last night I was at a friend's house who wanted to learn, a rich man who, self-made man who came up and was lucky to make money but has little education. And he now feels himself short. Mm-hmm. See, when he gets into company, his English is bad. If he has to regulate, he can't write it properly. And so I go to his place to try to help him to improve, you see.
Oh, you never stop, huh?
I was there last night at 10 o'clock working with him. So I can't give up that to go to teach for them.
To teach for the deacons,
huh? Because I will lose the opportunity of helping my own people.
Mm.
And I have some poor ones here who really need help. You see, they can't afford them to come to the school.
Mm.
See,
this is a tuition school?
Oh, yes.
With government help, it still requires tuition?
Yes, still requires tuition. The government gives half. Those who get to school have both. Hello, you want me, sir? Or, the government gives half of their tuition, see?
Mm.
A little more, because now the tuition is $60 and the government gives 40.
Okay.
But we have 302 exhibitors this term. And you see, out of the 900, or nearly 1,000 that we have, we have 300 exhibitions.
Now, what's
the science themselves so much now with the movements that nobody knows anything about, like the God movement and so on, and Bishop McGrath and Yacht and all that, that he sees himself in a kind of romantic and historical perspective. So, that when he is speaking about more recent history, the orchestra is really often
fantasizing.
Where he gets involved, where the other people he's talking about, like my grandmother, so he's quite distracted. But when he gets involved, he sees it through his peculiar point of view. So I just warn you, you got to watch that. But there are ways in which you can double check on him, you see.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chap called Reggie Fairpoint in New York, Reginald Fairpoint. He's a journalist, he works at ABC. My father taught us school, but he's 75, so you know, he's 70-something, so he's pretty good. There's a chapter of teaching at the moment called Admiral Lurie, who's related to us, and who lived in England for years, and lived in America during the Garvey times.
Mm.
And he had been a great student of African affairs at the British Museum, and so on. He was
and what's his name?
Admiral Lurie, and he was
Where?
Admiral Lurie.
How do you spell his last name?
W-O-R-R-E-L-L.
Worm. Oh, yeah.
He is a great friend of the Siegfried, Crowley and Kruma, Joaquin Neata. They used to meet together like 5 times a week when nobody knew that they were going to be leaders or anything like that. And they started with George Padmore, a thing called an African movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. But Admiral Ward is right here in Barbados, and I can introduce you to him. And Raphael, if I could get hold of his telephone number.
We met a girl in World, I think, somewhere while we were here. I don't remember where it
was. There you are, how then?
I don't remember now.
Did you go to
I remember, I seem to remember that name.
At Holiday Inn. Is the one of the teachers name?
No, I don't remember.
One of the teachers at the Modern as well.
Yes.
Right here.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
right
where
there.
We
That's
met
him. Wrong.
Oh.
I don't think my father got on too well.
You mean a little light fellow?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, we met him.
Yeah, well, he's a friend of mine.
Your father introduced us to him.
He knows more of
light fellow.
That's
uh-huh.
right.
Yeah.
He's a kind of cousin on my mother's side. Mother's side. He's a kind of cousin. My mother, too. So I look back to Australia and England, but he, you know, you've heard of George Patton Lawrence.
Wouldn't do.